Penguin Random House Audio presents White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America, by Nancy Eisenberg. Read for you by Kirsten Potter. While the author has made every effort to provide accurate internet addresses and other contact information at the time of publication, neither the publisher nor the author assumes any responsibility for errors or for changes that occur after publication. Further, the publisher does not have any control over and does not assume any responsibility for author or third-party websites or their content. In memory of Gerda Lerner and Paul Boyer. Preface to the 2016 edition. This book was originally published in the middle of the contentious 2016 presidential election season. By describing historical patterns, it had the effect of bringing some clarity to the otherwise feverish rhetorical muddle. And yet, in the aftermath of the election, conventional wisdom did little to improve upon the pre-election confusion. As ABC reported, Donald Trump's shocking electoral success represented the triumph of class over identity. It made no sense otherwise to analysts caught short. If the undeniable factors of racism and misogyny did not tilt the balance at the polls, then the surging return of class in politics must have. Searching for explanations is natural, but ABC did as punditry is wont to do and produced a false dichotomy in its effort to find a simple answer. The truth is, it's not one or the other. Class and identity politics operate in tandem. While it is true that the major candidates who competed in 2016 all fell back on some form of a class-conscious vocabulary in advancing their positions, it cannot be said that identity politics disappeared in the face of surging class issues. From the outset of the Democratic primary process, while Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont was calling for a class revolution, he drew in enormous numbers of millennials across the social spectrum who felt the weight of college loans. Despite Sanders' claims that his opponent was asking women to vote for her on the basis of her gender alone, frontrunner Hillary Clinton directed her appeal to voters on economic issues common to all working families. From early on in the primary, she focused alike on the pocketbook issue of child care and the racial and class roots of inner-city violence. Yet both the Democratic contenders had to make themselves likable and familiar. Sanders looked like a rumpled professor and sounded like a vintage 60s radical, speaking truth to power. No wonder students liked him. Clinton drew in some of the younger, lean-in audience and also won over older African-American women because of her proven loyalty to the black community. Emotional bonds dominate the imagined conversation between candidate and voter, with little overt reference to class. And yet, in the immediate, analytic, or pundit-driven aftermath, it was class all the way. Going against the grain, in a widely cited op-ed, Columbia University professor Mark Lilla wrote in the New York Times just after the election that it was not class at all that lay at the root of Hillary Clinton's loss to Donald Trump. He blamed her defeat on a left-friendly version of identity politics. Trump's rise was not about class-inflected racism or white lash, he insisted, but served instead to expose liberals' obsessive need to grant anyone who wanted it membership in a disadvantaged group, black, gay, female, and others. He argued that the Democrats, by their reductionist tendency, had caused white, rural, religious Americans to see themselves as ignored, even threatened. The liberal agenda was fueling a hostility toward political correctness. Therefore, if the Democratic Party wished to do better, it would have to recover a pre-identity politics and re-emphasize Americans' shared values. Once again, it was a narrowly defined view of voting and of identity. Owing to Trump's eccentricities, blaming Clinton was inevitable. But the flaws in Professor Lilla's logic run deeper. His assumption that there was a time when Democratic politics was pre-identity reflects the larger problem of many respected commentators, attachment to an idealized conception of American democracy. American party politics has exploited the rhetoric of identity at least as far back as Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson. Given the resilience of the white trash slur, rural working-class whites hardly needed liberal lingo to feel alienated. Illogically, Lilla uses Bill Clinton's candidacy as one of his examples of identity-free politics. Yet, as I detail in these pages, Clinton was a poster child of self-marketing. At the time, Republicans engaged in an unrelenting campaign to challenge Clinton's legitimacy as president, making every effort to label him a Southern bumpkin. In response, Clinton cleverly refashioned himself as the Arkansas Elvis and admitted at times to being a beer-drinking bubba. He played Heartbreak Hotel on the saxophone and posed with a mule on the campaign trail. For the poor white kid from Hope, Clinton's public image conjured nostalgia for the 1950s Elvis. No one was more skilled than the comeback kid in constructing an identity for himself that bridged North and South and in repackaging his personality so as to make him acceptable to working-class white men. The Yale liberal wore blue suede shoes. If a serious scholar such as Lilla could get Bill Clinton wrong, it's no surprise that Trump would succeed in confounding so many smart people, too. Journalists throughout 2016 scrambled to figure out what the attraction was to this loud, endlessly self-promoting New Yorker. They were sure it was some brand new phenomenon born of reality TV and social media. But conventional wisdom was again wrong to see the 2016 election as a break from the past. Like many before him, Trump had tapped into a rich vein of identity politics, the embrace of the common man, the working stiff, the forgotten rural American. American democracy's quirky past haunted the Trump campaign. He was not the first cranky businessman to run for high office, even in recent memory. Ross Perot was, capturing 19% of the popular vote in 1992. Nor was Trump the first millionaire mogul with Hollywood ties to seek the presidency. That was William Randolph Hearst, a century ago. And he certainly can't claim to be the first outsider who promised to clean up Washington and embody the hopes and dreams, and fears, of the common man. That honor belongs to Andrew Jackson. As critically, he was not the first politician to question the pedigree of a sitting president, either. James Vardaman did that in spades when he insulted President Theodore Roosevelt. Trump's rhetorical appeal to the silent majority was stolen from Richard Nixon. Sarah Palin paved the way for him as an earlier version of a Republican reality TV populist. Trump's favorite slogan, "Make America Great Again," was, of course, Ronald Reagan's first. The argument of this book is that America's class history is a more complicated story than we've previously considered. The past informs the present. Presidential candidates are not masters of their own destiny. Rather, they are often a patchwork of rhetorical scripts, familiar gestures, political styles inherited from their predecessors, and whatever else they happen to borrow from the grab bag of popular culture. Critics lament that our 24-hour news cycle turned the 2016 election into a horse race or a sideshow. And they're right. It was treated as a kind of sporting event. But Democratic politicians have always had to lure in voters. In the early 19th century, Southern backcountry voters came for the free food, the fistfights, and such rowdy forms of entertainment as the gander pull. In this indelicate contest, two men on horseback competed for the honor of yanking off the head of a goose. As in the squatter's tale about old Shug, men at the polls expected to get a serving of whiskey and brown sugar as they listened to long-winded speeches. It is in the nature of Democratic politics for office seekers to appeal with little subtlety to the tastes of the electorate. In the early 20th century, in his run for governor and the U.S. Senate, Jeff Davis of Arkansas gained the favor of his working-class audiences by ripping off his collar and rolling up his sleeves. He intentionally imitated the uncouth, ungrammatical speech of the lower classes. Even Lyndon Johnson had to canvass in Texas for his Senate seat with a traveling band. Governor Big Jim Folsom of Alabama strutted across the stage barefoot. Trump's antics mirror this long tradition. One of his campaign managers, Paul Manafort, admitted at one point that Trump was simply projecting an image. Who's surprised? Americans have a taste for a democracy of manners, which is different from real democracy. Voters accept huge disparities in wealth while expecting their elected leaders to appear to be no different from the rest of us. By talking tough, by
sample complete. Ready to continue?